You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
To talk about crushing below or crushing above on a little baby so that you can get an intact heart or an intact lung or an intact liver for sale. There's no way to defend language like that.
If we pervert the word of God by not speaking the law just to try to get along or to coexist, we're ultimately going to miss out on the wonders of the gospel.
I think often when we pray the Lord's Prayer, oh boy, forgive us our sins as we forgive others. Oh no, my sins aren't going to be forgiven. No, Luther says, stop being stupid. Look at the gospel promise.
Didgeridoo players in Iowa, love issues, etc.
I got to wonder whether this was part of the goal of the sexual revolution. Do you remember the scares in the 70s? About the population bomb, the U.S. population was going to grow to such a proportion we wouldn't be able to sustain ourselves. That proved to be untrue. In fact, the opposite proved to be true. According to the latest reports, the U.S. fertility rate is lower than it has ever been since it was first recorded. Down from 1957, a fertility rate of about 123 births per 1,000 women, we're currently sitting at, well, let's see, much lower than that, at about, I think it's about 59. What it says is, while there may not be less Americans in the future, there certainly will be less than there would have been if people were having more children. What does this mean economically? And what I wonder is whether or not this was part of the goal of the sexual revolution. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live on this Tuesday afternoon, the 16th of August. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest to talk about those low U.S. fertility rates. We'll also talk about a legal challenge to Utah's anti-polygamy law. Then Pastor Tom Baker will join us. We'll teach a Sunday school lesson, Three Men in the Fiery Furnace in Daniel chapter 3. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. You can send us a tweet at issuesetc or leave a question, a comment, or a show suggestion at the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, thanks so much for having me on.
I got to wonder whether or not this low fertility rate or numbers like this were among the goals of the sexual revolution.
Well, yeah, to be perfectly honest, I think the people who wanted the sexual revolution in the sense of wanting sex to be a casual recreational activity, I think that group of people was not particularly interested or concerned about the birth rate overall. But what is true is that there have been for some time people who were interested in lowering the birth rate, going all the way back to the eugenics movement at the turn of the century, who wanted, you know, fewer of those poor people having babies and more of those good people having babies. That morphed into population control overall, which was John D. Rockefeller in the middle of the 20th century, and then on to zero population growth people in the 70s in response to the population bomb. So, yes, there certainly were people who wanted flat, you know, no fertility growth or zero or, you know, fertility decline. And many of the sexual revolutionaries, in a sense, these two groups of people were, kind, you could say they were hiding behind each other, you know. So the full-on eugenics type person is not really very attractive, right? And so people don't necessarily say, well, I want to give out contraception to so that poor people stop having babies. Nobody really wants to say that, even if it's true. So the eugenics people and the population control people could kind of hide behind feminism and recreational sex. And at the same time, some of the feminist and recreational sex people can hide behind the idea of, oh my gosh, there are too many people, so we should just sterilize the sexual act completely, and that'll be good for everyone. So there's been a kind of synergy between those two groups, I would say, Todd.
The sexual revolution certainly did have a hand in one of the other figures that went along with these U.S. fertility rates, and that is the ever-growing age of first-time childbirth is moving up, I think, almost 2 years in the last 10 years, something of that nature, to about 27 years old.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they certainly the feminist part of the sexual revolution had that in mind, you know, that people should be postponing childbearing in favor of having careers and in favor of women being independent. So if the idea is that you can't count on a husband to be there to take care of you, you really don't feel like you can have your first child until you can take care of that child yourself. And so therefore, women have to postpone their fertility, and therefore the fertility rate drops, right? And so in that story that you posted, I suppose you have that story posted on your show page and stuff. I clicked through some of the different links that were on there, and one of them took you to a site that compared women's actual fertility with women's desired fertility. And Todd, in every single major industrialized country, from Australia to New Zealand, every single one, women wish they had more children than they actually have had. So in that sense, it's been a complete bust as far as helping women, as far as actually helping women achieve what they themselves want. Most women, on average, women wish they had more children than they actually have. I thought that graph was absolutely tragic.
The other thing that is unstated by the fertility rate is the role of abortion,
yes,
especially in the U.S. I once ran the numbers. This was probably about 10 years ago now, but ran the numbers. If you include abortions in the U.S. infant mortality rate, our infant mm-hmm. mortality rate goes from being among the lowest in the world to among the highest. I think only Uganda or something like that had a higher infant mortality rate than the U.S., somewhere near 22%, if you count abortion. And abortion certainly cannot be counted out of these fertility numbers, can they?
Yes. See, so the fertility is counting live births. You know, so it doesn't count abortion. It doesn't count miscarriage, right? It only counts live births. But if you looked at the number of pregnancies, I think you would have a similar kind of number. In other words, it's not that people are having fewer children because they're having less sex, or they're having sex only in an environment where it would be beneficial to the child to bring forth a child. People are having fewer babies because they're killing about a quarter of them. You know, so that's not any big moral progress, I don't think.
Let's talk a little bit about how the lifestyle left might look at these numbers. Some will laud these lower fertility rates as progress and as evidence of easier access to contraception, and that push has been working. What's your response?
Well, that's a much more complicated question than that simple statement would suggest, okay? Because the increased access to contraception has also had the effect of people having sex under more and more circumstances that cannot possibly support a pregnancy. And so therefore they feel they need an abortion, right? And so far from reducing abortion, some researchers have found pretty clearly that increased access to contraception increases pregnancy and increases abortion. Right. So I think the truly significant thing, and the lifestyle left never wants to come right out and say this, but I think the truly significant thing is not so-called access to contraception. People have known how to avoid pregnancy for a long, long time, Todd. The really significant thing is the contraceptive ideology. And that's what I call it. That's what it is. It's an ideology which says that a good and decent society should separate sex from procreation, that everybody in the society can act as if they have perfectly contracepted sex, and you can treat sex as if it's a sterile recreational activity with no moral or social consequences. That's the contraceptive ideology. And that actually has nothing to do with contraceptive technology, and that has everything to do with our laws, social structures, and the fantasy ideology that we create for ourselves.
Purely in economic terms, what does it mean if there are fewer children today and, as we know, in the future with the baby boom generation and subsequent generations probably going to be living longer? What kind of picture does that paint economically for the U.S.?
Well, I tell you, there are a number of things to say about that. First of all, calling attention to the thing you just mentioned, which is that the birth pyramid is inverting. So you have more and more dependent people depending upon fewer and fewer working age people. That's the big economic problem that we're facing and that many countries around the world are facing. So you've got an aging population. People who become, you know, in the natural course of things, as people get older, they become more dependent. And you have fewer and fewer people who are actually working to pay the taxes that will take care of the social entitlements that have been promised to all those people. And even if you took the government out of the picture, Todd, and you just looked at, just pretend everybody has to do it by themselves without any help from the government, it's still true if you have bigger space between the generations and you have fewer and fewer children, then sooner or later you're going to have a generation of people who don't have the resources to take care of a new baby and to take care of aging parents at the same time. You know, always in the past, there have been there has been some kind of expansion so that there are enough people in their prime working age to take care of grandma and to take care of new baby at the same time. But that's the jam that we're increasingly getting ourselves into. So that problem of taking care of dependent people, that's a huge problem. The other big economic problem is just that having more people who are prime age workers increases the growth rate of the economy. There's just no doubt about that. There was a very interesting guy who I think his name is Harry Dent. He was a stock market kind of guy. You know, he analyzed stock market trends and so on and gave advice to people and all this kind of thing. And he noticed that if you took the long-term trend of the stock market and you took the long-term trend of fertility and you took those two graphs and you laid them one on top of the other, with a separation of about 40 years, you would find they matched perfectly. And so what that means is the number of babies you have today predicts what your economic activity is going to be 40 years from now. See? And so today, there's absolutely nothing we can do today to get us more 40-year-olds tomorrow. You know, that can't happen, right? Unless you import people. And you can do that one country at a time, but you can't do that globally. You know, population is collapsing all over the world. So this is a long-term economic problem that we've built for ourselves as well.
The other issue I wanted you to address is a legal challenge in Utah to its polygamy law. Some people said this was never going to happen, but the headline reads, Sister Wives case moves slowly toward Supreme Court. What can you tell us about this, and how did we get here, Jennifer?
Well, you know, Todd, we did talk about this, didn't we? You know, we talked about that if you establish the legal principle that people who love each other should be allowed to get married, there's no particular reason why that should be limited to the number two. Why should it be only two people who love each other? Why not three, four, and five people who love each other? And so the legal principle that allows genderless marriage to be intelligible and even constitutionally required, that same legal principle has no necessary stopping point. And so that's why we are where we are with that case. And I don't see what they're going to say to put a stop to it, you know. But the other interesting thing I would call your attention to, and that I want your listeners to notice, as far as I know, that Sister Wives case does not have the backing of any of the big gay legal organizations like Lambda Legal or Human Rights Campaign, the different organizations that were so instrumental in pushing through genderless marriage. They're not involved in this. And I think the reason why they're not involved in it is because they got what they wanted, namely the legal principle is established. And so polygamy and incest and those things will take care of themselves. They don't have to spend their resources on other kinds of court challenges. They're using their resources instead to promote the transgender agenda because that's the new, true, innovative next step to the sexual revolution, which is break down the barriers of gender itself and put the gender ideology into place. That's where they're putting all their resources. So yes, we're probably going to end up with polygamy and legalized incest. That's probably going to happen. But at the same time, there's this whole other front opening up that includes all the transgender issues. And I think most people did not realize how quickly transgenderism would follow on the heels of gay marriage. I didn't. I figured it would come, but I didn't know it would come like the very next day, practically, it seems like.
Is it also, since the primary concern here is to target gender and the distinction between male and female, polygamy doesn't really do that for you if you're kind of an equality rights person, because it's still a man and just a number of women, or if the roles were reserved, it'd be a woman and a number of men. You still got that binary problem there, and that still kind of plays into the distinction between male and female too strongly. Transgenderism is a more direct route.
That's right. That's right. And also, you know, historically, you cannot find any historical civilization of any size that was symmetrical on this issue. In other words, any society of any size whatsoever that has multiple marriage, it's always one man with multiple women. And if you were if you're a feminist, you should looking at those societies should really give you the weebie-jeebies. And I don't know how they're going to put a stop to the truly misogynistic aspects of polygamy as it's actually practiced. Sister Wives is a Hollywood rendition of something that is, as a social fact, not going to be stable. I mean, they look so wholesome. He's so nice to those ladies and so on and so forth. But societies that have polygamy over a long period of time do not look like that, right? Because what happens is women become scarce and some men hog all the wives. You know, the rich men and the privileged men have access to a lot of women, and there's some men who don't have any women. And so what the society as a whole ends up doing is marrying off younger and younger women, putting more and more constraints on the behavior of women. Women become more like property and less like free agents, because even though they're valuable, they can't cash out their value, so to speak, you know. So it's just like what we see in China with the scarcity of brides, right? Because of the big gender imbalance that's been created by the one child policy and gender specific abortion and all of that. You know, economists would say, well, gosh, there are fewer women. Women should have strong bargaining power because they're the scarce resource. This should be great for women. But that turns out not to be true, because a 13-year-old girl cannot negotiate on her own behalf. It's her father who has more power. It's the guy who's selling brides. It's the guy who's doing prostitution and human trafficking, who essentially own those women who are valuable assets. He's the one who benefits from the scarcity of women, not the women themselves. And so that's what polygamy does to the society long term. It turns out not to be good for women at all.
When we warned people that if the courts adopted legal principles about marriage as simply love between consenting adults, that it would eventually, and in this case didn't take too long,
right,
bring about acceptance, legal acceptance or social acceptance of polygamy and polyamory, et cetera. We were told that we were alarmists, that we were arguing on the slippery slope, and that this would never happen. What are your thoughts now?
Well, you know, people said that, but it was obvious when they were saying it. Even when they were saying it, the reason they said it is because they didn't have a response to the argument. You know, you come back and say, well, what do you mean by a slippery slope? Is that supposed to end the argument just because you use that phrase? That's supposed to end the argument? No, you're articulating a legal principle. Show us the stopping point. What is the principle by which you would stop that legal principle from being applied to these other kinds of cases? And of course, they never had an answer to that. So yeah, we knew this was going to happen. And you know, people want to, you know, go back and look at our debates, look at the things that I wrote, the things you and I talked about by going back to our podcasts and things like that. You can see that we were talking about this, you know, for quite a while. That this was the only logical outcome of this process.
The one thing that I noticed that is in our first subject, a dwindling number, and is virtually absent from the discussion of polygamy or the redefinition of marriage is children.
Oh, gosh. Oh, gosh. Todd, you know, if we would ever talk about children, if we ever took children really seriously, the whole sexual revolution would collapse. Because the principal point of the sexual revolution is to say, well, they never come out and say this, but the point really is that adults are entitled to the sex lives they want with a minimum of inconvenience, and children just have to accept whatever the adults give them. That's the reality of the thing, whether you're talking about divorce or cohabitation or single parenthood or certainly abortion, for goodness sake. You know, if we ever were to say, you know what, adults owe something to children, adult society owes something to children, and we can't blow that off by saying, oh, kids are resilient. When people say kids are resilient, what they really mean to say is, I'm about to do something that's going to harm a child, and I don't want to think about it too closely. And that, to me, Todd, this has just gone on long enough. This has got to stop.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She is author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. You can purchase this book and find out more about the Ruth Institute under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Jen, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Tom Baker. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson. Well, a iconic Sunday school lesson, replete with a lot of drama. And it's a little bit scary if you stop and think about it. The three men in the fiery furnace. Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest on the other side on this Tuesday afternoon, August the 16th. We'll be talking about Daniel chapter 3.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.